the truth is, and the piece that's just hugely missed right now in the industry is that if a CISO or any company buys an information security solution and they have not first dimensioned what their inherent and residual risk exposures are in the problem, business problem that they're trying to solve, and after they've implemented, if they cannot articulate how much inherent and how much residual risk they've reduced, they've just blown their money. They just wasted it. It's not a business case that's predicated on how much you spend over time, how much of it is CapEx, how much of it is OpEx, how much of it is subscription, what's in the cloud, what's not in the cloud. Almost none of that is relevant unless you're looking at things purely operationally.
Hey everyone, Steve Tout here, creator and host of the Nonconformist Innovation Podcast. As you know, in every episode, I invite entrepreneurs, executives, and innovators at the top of their game with a track record of serial success and actionable insights to share. Have you ever wondered about strategies for navigating your career and identity after, say, 20 years in the business? Are you eager to hear about nonconformist viewpoints on the popular zero trust movement? Is identity really the new perimeter? In this episode, I interview a very special guest. He is a chief customer information officer, identity-centric security evangelist, former CISO, former CIO, pragmatist, game changer, and world traveler. He is none other than Richard Byrd. I hope you enjoy this episode, and as always, thank you for listening to the show. Hey Richard, it's great to have this opportunity to sit down for a conversation and talk about modern identity with you. Not only do you have great taste in bow ties, you have quite a distinguished background in the identity world with a variety of roles, and most recently as Chief Customer Information Officer at Ping Identity. Is that CCIO for short? I love it.
Yes, it is.
You're a CrossFitter, a supporter of breast cancer awareness, degreed in political science and risk management, and serve on several boards. Richard, the pleasure is truly mine today.
Thank you.
Ping has been the darling of the industry for many years now, so the answer to this question is probably an obvious one. But why did you join Ping Identity? Did Andre twist your arm? I mean, you had a great gig at Optiv, the world's largest SI and most trusted advisor for IAM and cybersecurity on the planet. So why the move?
Oh, it's a great question. It's one of those situations where I'm super thankful for, you know, all of the scars and bruises I've accumulated over my life that gave me enough experience to finally have this many options. You know, Andre and I had struck up an intellectual relationship a couple of years ago. I had spoken at a cloud identity summit before the name was changed to Identiverse. And we just started talking and he started drawing my operational experiences and background out and asking me tons of questions about you know, what's it really like to run the function and how, you know, how difficult and or easy was it to work with different solutions. And through the course of that, you know, I really appreciated the fact that, you know, he was willing to listen to me complain about how many solution providers just didn't understand long-term operational consequences and cost consequences of their solutions. And then we, you know, kept in contact with each other. And last year, I spoke at Identiverse again, very well received keynote that the audience enjoyed. You know, many of my colleagues enjoyed. And then Andre, a few weeks later, just in the course of a email exchange, said, "Hey, you know, I think if you're interested, why don't you come work for me?" And it was a little difficult for me because when I joined Optiv, I left the corporate world. Completely. I was just burnt out after 20 plus years in IT executive roles and IT cyber, or executive cybersecurity roles. And almost from the moment that I walked into Optiv, I had this, you know, great set of opportunities presented to me by personally by the CEO, by Dan Burns. And I really do owe him a personal debt. He gave me the permission and the opportunities to speak, which I did about 30 times or so for Optiv. And in the course of speaking, that it introduced me to wider and wider audiences, and you know, kind of bringing it around to, you know, Ping as a company, Ping Identity as a company, of all the different choices that were out there for me relative to solution providers. Andre and I are like minded where the industry is going. He brings the perspective of the entrepreneur and the longtime innovator, and I feel like I'm the opposite side of the same coin, just with the perspective of the operator and the customer.
That's great. Yeah, it's awesome to kind of, you know, have the opportunity. Most people end up being career IT people or career entrepreneurs and, you know, don't always get a chance to like switch tracks and try and feel things, other roles. Okay, my ears perked when you said that solution providers don't understand the operational and cost consequences of their solutions. This is a subject that's near and dear to me, as I too spent over a decade in the trenches managing complex global IAM implementations. So now in your thinking, how do you frame this issue and speak to this at an executive level? You know, I'm sure based on my own experiences that breaches are a result in gaps in operating procedures, not always because of technology, right? Think of the Deloitte data breach, not having 2FA enabled here. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think it's a super timely question. In the course of any given day, I'm probably plowing through 20 different news feeds around cybersecurity topics and privacy and all that good stuff. Somebody has to read it. And actually, one just came across the wire today that I think is so relevant to the question that you just asked, which the CEO of Tenable, Amit Yoran, gave an interview.
Yes, I saw that.
At RSA. Yeah. And that just makes me so happy because it makes me feel like maybe some folks are starting to get it. He raises in the course of that interview this question about if you keep buying the next coolest solution, you know, with the blinky lights and the easy button, and you're not doing the basics correctly, which is something that if you're a practitioner in an organization, you beg for your executives and your board to listen to you on. And I thought it was really fascinating. He was, you know, as blunt as saying that the vast majority of the cybersecurity solution space is smoke and mirrors. And it feeds right into the operational and cost consequences of these solutions. Most of them are, it's fascinating to me. So many solutions, and I go way back. I've owned all of the big solutions as an app owner. And it's fascinating to me how many solutions were pitched as platforms, but are really single point solutions. Now I've got to buy 10 different ones and, you know, I got to hope that they all integrate together. And then another wave of solutions with a heavy orientation towards cloud and discovering all kinds of information there. But if you ask for any automation, nope, we don't do that, right? Somebody still has to sit in front of a screen and sort through those alerts. And the way that I have phrased this in previous speaking engagements, you know, the risk there is amazing to me, because we all know how these analysts respond when they get buried in tons and tons of data that they need to sift through manually. They start creating rules to weed out false positives. And then somewhere in that bucket of false positives is the bad thing. But there's so much noise being generated, you know, by so many different solutions that are either unintegrated or they're single purpose, that you have to hire more staff. You have to, you know, add more capacity relative to the management of the function. And this has been a pattern I've seen repeated for well over a decade.
Yeah, you know, I the fact that you're seeing these patterns for over a decade, by the way, you know, hats off to Amit. You know, I've always enjoyed listening to him speak, you know, tennis shoe wearing, in blue jeans, giving a keynote. I love it. You know, love hearing the man speak. But your partnership with Andre, I think, is brilliant as well. Bringing that deep operational expertise with the, you know, the visionary and the depth of technical background that Andre has. I didn't prepare you for this question, but I want to take it on because Andre was just posted this on LinkedIn today. He has had quite a few recent conversations with CISOs, and one of the recurring themes that he hears is many CISOs see identity as an operations function, not a security function. Let's take a couple of minutes and expand on that, right? I think you laugh and we all see the humor in it, but it also paints a pretty grim picture of if the CISO isn't, you know, can't see, you know, past his nose in terms of, you know, why identity needs to be managed in a certain way, or see the opportunity, you know, to help the business scale safely. I mean, what's your take on that? And how are you and Andre kind of taking on that mindset?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting moment for all of this to have come together. I'm glad it took us a little bit to get things on the schedule, because between RSA and some other activities that have been going on over the last couple of weeks, it's probably given us some really, really great information to kind of go over. And this is one of them. It's kind of fascinating to me that the CISO insight that he shared, I know the CISO that he's talking about personally very, very well.
And, so it's not fiction. It really happens. CISOs really say that.
No, we've worked together in the past. And I will tell you, this particular CISO is very well known for being.
I'm falling off my chair, Richard.
Very, very blunt and very forthright. And was literally just walking in the hall and had a conversation with Andre about a readback of this conversation, and I said, there's nothing that I can disagree with, right? There's what I love about the series of quotes that Andre posted is that this is a CISO that's taking personal accountability and leadership accountability. You know, just saying, hey, look, and one of the things that I found fascinating is, and it speaks to what Amit was saying, is that we have companies that have tons of security solutions on site that they've never deployed, right? They've bought and they've got, one OEM, out of the box rule running, or they've only applied an application, or they've only, and there's, that to me is a reflection of that operations function that particular CISO was talking about. We're still not in a place where CISOs are native born, right? They're an indigenous species to security. They came from IT. They came from infrastructure. They came from app dev. They came from audit, compliance, and myself as well. I came from mergers and acquisitions program management, and then moved into IT management for app dev and infrastructure, and so I'm not a native to information security, and so there's this idea that I buy a solution, I implement a solution, my problems are solved, and that's still a very operational mindset. I think the big break here is, and I just posted something about this myself just the other day. The big break here is that there is a massive lack of awareness and understanding around why you purchase a security solution, right? People will say, CISOs will say, and heads of compliance and all will say, you need to buy that solution to fix this compliance problem, right? You need to buy that solution in order to fix this audit issue. You need to buy this in order to make the DOJ happy, or the DOD or SEC. You just kind of go down a laundry list of alphabet soup and the regulators. The truth is, and the piece that's just hugely missed right now in the industry is that if a CISO or any company buys an information security solution and they have not first dimensioned what their inherent and residual risk exposures are in the problem, business problem that they're trying to solve, and after they've implemented, if they cannot articulate how much inherent and how much residual risk they've reduced, they've just blown their money. They just wasted it. It's not a business case that's predicated on how much you spend over time, how much of it is CapEx, how much of it is OpEx, how much of it is subscription, what's in the cloud, what's not in the cloud. Almost none of that is relevant unless you're looking at things purely operationally. What's relevant is reducing risk, right? Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's, the other side of the coin, those CISOs who don't have good relationships with the business are probably the ones who are short-sighted to say, oh, this is an operational concern, where identity now is driving the conversation. It's helping provide and enable end-to-end user experiences, help drive, upsell and cross-sell opportunities, and generally, for large organizations especially, help prospect customers and existing customers feel like the company knows them when they're going from one department to the next. I mean, think about from, the initial product sale to engaging with the company to get customer support, right? There's got to be a smooth transition in that experience.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I certainly some of this, and again, we can refer back to the Tenable interview, certainly some of this is obligation and responsibility that weighs back on the solution side, weighs back on the solutions integrator side, you know, that we're, if we're in the business of, you know, stamping and selling widgets that have X percentage of margin, and we're not really in the business of reducing risk. And I do believe that's what, you know, Amit is making really, really clear, which is, you know, and this has been a big frustration point for me. This is one of the reasons why coming to Ping Identity was a no-brainer for me relative to Andre's, you know, attitude. I need to reel this back. I do feel like I'm singularly unique, not special, but singularly unique in the information security trades, because I have been a CIO, I've been a CISO, I've been a, you know, global head of identity, I've been a consultant, I've actually tried my hand at sales, I was really, really bad at it, and I've been a strategic advisor, so I've really been the full spectrum. The only thing I haven't been personally is an entrepreneur. And in spending a lot of time with all these solution providers now on this side of the fence as one of the team for security solution providers, I have been really, really disappointed in how many companies are not in the business of actually solving problems. They're in the business of getting their multiple. They're in the business of getting their valuation. They're in the business of getting their next trade acquisition. They're not in the business of actually solving the risk equation where risk is reduced. And I do think that, and Andre's not alone in this in the industry. I know several CEOs and CEO founders who still get up every morning and they want to fix problems, right? But I do think that the vast majority of the universe relative to security solutions and solutions integration around cybersecurity is still focused on cranking up the bucks. And there's been an endless supply of those, for the last several years.
You're not missing a lot because you haven't been an entrepreneur. To be an entrepreneur the right way, and I know you have a lot of scar tissue already and a lot of experiences, multiply that by 10 and you'll get to at least imagine what it's like to be an entrepreneur. You have to really, really want that badly to go after that kind of experience. Just ask Andre. He and I have commiserated a bit over that as well.
Well, I know that I'm not built that way, so it will be the one thing that I leave on the table.
You know, that you guys just make the perfect pairing because, you know, with all those other offices that you've held, you know, Richard, I think you're the perfect guy to have on the Nonconformist Innovation Podcast because you can help see the big picture and drive that value equation, which is, hey, identity is more than just compliance, right? It's it's not about single sign-on and operational efficiency anymore. You know, there's this long list of things that make identity a profit center and help drive business forward, right? So let's talk, let's change, the speed just a little bit and go from, abstract and business context to actually what you're excited about doing at Ping Identity to address, first of all, the risk side. There's a rise in frequency and severity of data breaches in the past 3 to 4 years. The world has seen the largest breaches of the 21st century, in that time. How is Ping Identity and how are you thinking about, evolving or updating your product and services strategy from one that is managed on focusing on identities and access to detecting and mitigating risk?
Yeah, it's fascinating to me how fast the world around identity control has moved. I believe in the last 2 years, it's shifted towards innovation, evolution, and change than it did in the prior 10. And I do think that there are some gears that are driving that. The most important gear that I talk about frequently is that the reality of what's coming down the road with the EU's PSD2 open banking, and it's also being adopted in Australia, where it's not just open banking, but it's open banking across all verticals. And I was just down in Australia having a lot of conversations with a lot of companies and government agencies about that. This reality that these regulations and these demands are driving us towards a world of a demand for secure customer identity. You know, back in my day, man, customer identity, I remember I had to control and manage some because they were high risk, and I had to build a whole, you know, set of solutions to be able to do that. You know, but for the most part, you know, if somebody came to me and said, I need you to secure customer identities, I would say, go talk to the chief marketing officer. That's it, right? That's all marketing. That's all sales. That's not my issue. That's causing a huge shift in thinking. And I do believe that we are on a path where we're going to see, and I'm actively involved in lobbying for these changes, whether they be with our own government or other governments. I've stepped into this new space, which is interesting to me. I do think that what we're going to see is you cannot say, here's all the regulations, protect a customer's data, and then hold the world responsible, banks and insurance companies and government agencies, hold them responsible for protecting that data, and then don't extend the requirement for protection to the actual customer identity. Because if we say it's the customer's responsibility, but it's the customer's data, we're going to protect the data, but we're not going to protect the customer, we literally have just defined the roadmap for
and a lot of other things. Yeah.
Like, you know, just
we think that security, you know, PSD2, GDPR, you know, these, you know, SOX, HIPAA, these are all coming at us. They've been around for a while, and yet we're still having data breaches. Right. So I think that these frameworks offer some really interesting conversations in the early, conversations around, hey, what should we be doing and why? Because if you don't do this basic set of things, hygiene, you're going to have feel some pain. You're going to get a fine, you know. So let's you know, looking at that through the lens of frameworks, you know, there's zero trust and lean trust, and you know, for example, mm-hmm. Gartner Carta, and these have become hyped concepts in the past year. Mm-hmm. Zero trust calls for a default deny stance on access policies, among other things. A lot easier said than done, having myself been in those trenches. And Gartner Carta focuses on layering this threat intelligence, context awareness, continuous monitoring, and so forth. You know, I know that Ping has made some headlines, you know, within the last year for its acquisition of Elastic Beam, which, you know, is kind of exciting to see Ping Identity evolving into, you know, bringing more value in this space. You know, with Elastic Beam being a hybrid cloud solution for protecting APIs with a artificial intelligence. So, you know, I guess you've seen this from the outside in, because this acquisition happened before you joined Ping Identity, and now you're on the inside. You know, how has this acquisition, how is this acquisition helping, you know, Ping Identity to evolve its intellectual property and capabilities on and in adaptive security? With intelligence and AI? And let me restate the question just simply. Demystify Ping Intelligent Identity Platform for us.
Sure. So in order to do that, I almost have to kind of bolt together a bit of a mini timeline around the points that you just made. So I've sat with, listened to, and talked with John Kindervag on Zero Trust. And we know that the genesis of Zero Trust was network, right? Which is so historically complementary to everything else in information security, because everything started with the network when we first started this business, right? So makes sense that the application of Zero Trust at the perimeter, you know, as it relates to packets, which was the way it was built initially, would be, you know, that approach. The challenge is that, you know, just mechanically, right, is everything in information security, if we look at the history of it, if we look at firewalls, if we look at encryptions, keys, all that good stuff, all of that worked in this kind of perimeter defined world. But guess what? When you try to drive application control, fine-grained application control, you know, from RBAC at the OS level for Windows, and you try to move into, you know, ABAC or fine-grained entitlements control at the applications, it failed everywhere because app dev managers didn't want to redesign their applications. Nobody wanted to go to a standard access control framework, whatever the case may be. So the truth is that zero trust will run into the same harsh realities on the application side as all of the perimeter-based security frameworks did when they came, through the traditional routes and, 10 and 20 years ago. So when we look at what needs to happen, we think, first of all, and this is what I love about Ping Identity, identity is not the perimeter, the new perimeter, right? That was been touted for several years. That's a really...
I'm glad you brought that up.
This is a really bad statement.
It is used a lot. And I think it's, until recently, one of those sayings that, was, it rolled off the tongue nicely, but people really didn't, break it down into what does that mean, actually?
Right. Well, that, you've heard me speak. I'm very pragmatic and sometimes a little contentious. And, but I've always said, look, if you buy that identity is the new perimeter, then Bob in accounting is the new port 80. And if you are, again, an old school, CISO like me, you think, well, do I want 1100 poorly managed firewall configuration rules on my perimeter? Or do I want 24,000 employees and each one of them is actually a risk exploit for me? So now I've just multiplied by my attack surface by, tens of thousands, right? This is the problem with this notion. So with Ping, our focus is identity is the core of security. Now we kind of wrap this back into the part that API and intelligence for identity plays. So one of the other things that has become a crushing reality as we've managed through, more and more complicated use cases, more and more demands for things like privilege escalation, de-escalation, in session, all that. We've been managing it with rules and policies. And again, those of us who have been around the block long enough know that rules and policies reach their logical limit in terms of being able to be managed, by huge staffs or even by systems themselves, because it's just too onerous. So the only way for us to be able to move forward and evolve, and this speaks to, where our direction is, the only way for us to move forward and evolve is to be able to apply intelligence in stream or alongside of accesses, whether they be workforce, customer, partners, vendors, alongside, so that informed, intelligent decisions are causing continuous data-driven authentication. Right. So the notion that we'd be able to do a privileged escalation just simply based on, a series of authenticatable items in a global authentication authority, a series of authenticatable items that would give us a super high confidence that that person is who they say they are and they're doing what they're supposed to be doing and they have what they're supposed to have. Now we can give them an escalated privilege grant for the moment that they need it and extract it, without ever changing any of the user's experience. And that's really where the future is going to be. And it's really close, is the way that I would phrase it. Now, the trick here is that you kind of start buckling all these pieces together. We're going to reach a critical mass and or a tipping point where the demand becomes secure customer identity. The demand becomes, we need to stop investing in security solutions that aren't yielding risk reductions. And we need to change security architectures to put the human being in the middle instead of the asset. And once we start to do that, it's going to become really, really apparent why we need intelligence. Because the universe of human beings, and I sometimes get criticized because it seems like I'm leaving out all the machine accounts and functional accounts. And my attitude is that if we could solve the human problem first, we'll take a big chunk of the risk out of there. So how about we attack the problem that we can solve immediately? Once we start to do that, we understand that the universe of identities, human identities that are going to need to be protected
is going
to be massive.
Yeah. Identity and access management market estimated to grow 12% annually over the next few years and become a $14 billion industry by 2023. And I think, I remember chatting with Andre a couple of years back prior to obviously to being acquiring Elastic Beam, saying, you know, Ping Identity needs a security brain. You know, you have all these gateways and, you know, rules, and they're static, and you kind of mend and mold and fashion identity and security how you want it. But, you know, then he the next security breach hits, and it's like, didn't think of that one. You know, so as things are evolving, you know, it sounds like, you know, Andre finally got his wish, and now Ping Identity Platform has a security brain, if you will. You know, so is there a role that, you know, like third party threat intelligence plays in augmenting AI and ML capabilities on your roadmap? Is this part of the equation? You know, can we expect some kind of risk scoring, or is that already happening behind the scenes, either inherently or through a CASB partner of Ping Identity?
It's a really observant question. It's a question that I think every one of the key security solutions providers, particularly those in identity, but certainly those in CASB, in threat and vulnerability management, and a couple of other domains, are asking, right, of themselves. We certainly are as well. And one of the questions that we ask ourselves is are we moving into a space where we can no longer be a orient towards one domain within the security framework. And yet, on the other side, as I've talked with, you know, colleagues and friends in the CASB space and in the threat and vulnerability management space, as we've all begun to push into cloud, and we've all begun to push into some form of application of intelligence, those types of analytics, one of the things that is really becoming clear is that in order for you to be effective in reducing risk, kind of going back to the core of that, in order for you to be effective, you need additional information that isn't associated with the domain that you manage. So this is an interesting revelation for everybody in the industry right now, because as we're all looking around, we go, well, you know, if I want to manage, you know, threats associated to identities, then I need data about threats, right? If I want to do scoring relative to risks represented by the user, by the entity, by the company, I'm going to need that data, right? And then if I have a solution that, like Ping, is capable of functioning both directly on-prem and in the cloud, you know, the most dangerous view of a user is the partial view of a user. You know, so if I'm Ping and I have this end-to-end view of a user, that information becomes extremely valuable to the CASB players, to the threat and vulnerability management players, to the firewall players even. And as this has all started to come together, I believe the question that you asked is being asked in boardrooms all around the country right now, as to, do we get into that business? Do we add just enough functionality so it's good enough? Do we combine forces? Does it become partnership play? And you know this, you know, better than I do. But the reality is that virtually no security solutions providers have ever gone down the path of being key, tightly coupled, yeah, with another provider in another domain.
To avoid, right? This situation where once you have, you know, checked in, you can never leave, right? And if you're tightly coupled, you know, you're in a world of hurt down the road, and there's someone there just not thinking about future consequences, if I can put it politely.
Yeah. The trick is, though, is that if there's loose coupling, you create, you know, you mentioned something similar, right? I've never met a CISO in my life that said, I got hacked exactly the way that I thought I was going to get hacked. You always get hit where you don't see it, and loose coupling creates enough of an opportunity, you know, for capitalization for the bad guys. You know, tight coupling reduces that risk. So I think the industry is struggling greatly with how to begin to answer those questions. I'm certain that there are going to be a number of steps that we take, because they're going to be oriented towards being a broader
I think that has set of capabilities happen.
From a
and
platform
I think
standpoint.
You've been around the IDSA for a while. You know, although there are a lot of member companies there within the alliance, that doesn't mean tight coupling. It just implies cooperation, right? We're going to work with known standards, whether that be FIDO or, you know, SAML or OAuth or SCIM, whatever it may be, or, you know, some new emerging standard that's going to help, you know, sharing signals to make sure that there's risk-informed access decisions, right? So, you know, I think as this ecosystem and the alliance gets bigger, tightly coupling is just impossible. Nobody wants to invest those resources up front to make that happen. But cooperation and you know, being directionally aligned adds a lot of value for joint customers.
Agreed. And to your point, I think we'll see more and more of it. The big challenge is that each of us are now recognizing that data is king, and that we may each have data that each of us would want. I do see kind of almost the next derivation of identity proofing may be something along the lines of subscription stores of authenticatable data, right? It could be both anonymized or specific to users. So you could see this rise of trusted authentication authorities being one of the next iterations. And then, you know, for us, as we're collecting information and data, we know that we collect tons of information that's relevant to that possibility. So I think it's early days, which is fascinating to me, but I think it's just also reflective of the fact that there was 10 years of overall underinvestment from an innovation standpoint, from an intellectual standpoint, and from a money standpoint in the identity space. You know, all of it was most of it was heavily oriented towards, you know, access provisioning and deprovisioning, which is where, you know, a lot of solutions still are. And we're only now moving into the realities of a fully securitized experience from the time a customer adopts point and they leave that digital point.
You know, we're hearing recently Australia's data breach reporting law now in full effect. The country had reported that nearly 75% of all cyber attacks in the past quarter involved the abuse of compromised credentials, username, passwords, etc. So this issue of compromised credentials is a growing problem that has a lot of people and businesses rightfully concerned. You know, what is your story for Ping customers that will give them the warm fuzzies and the confidence that, hey, you shouldn't be concerned about cyber criminals walking right through the front door with known good credentials? How can they be thinking proactively about mitigating that risk and that attack scenario?
I think that the confidence comes from the statement that I made earlier about who has the most complete view of a user or a customer, a partner, a vendor, right? And a human entity, right? And I think it's, you know, again, I think it's a fair criticism to call me out for not really diving into the topics of non-human entities.
We can have another podcast around that one.
But we've got enough problems managing the human space. Yeah. We can't get there yet, right? And I'm saying that as somebody that used to try and manage both aggressively, you know, but when we have the proof point that clearly shows in survey after survey that no matter what people are saying in boardrooms about cloud first, everything cloud, it doesn't work that way. I mean, the first reality is that the cloud is the marketing term for a co-located data center. I get that the software runs faster. I get that the clustering and all of that is a massive improvement over where we were years ago, but it's still somebody else's data center. And because of that, you know, the rise of a truly designed hybrid infrastructure is going to be the continuous reality for all of us, at least until, you know, the vast majority of us are either retired or dead. So, you know, we know mainframe, we know Linux, Unix, you know, at the local level, we know all of these, you know, mechanisms that make it impossible for people to leave, you know, any less than about 50% of their landed footprint on-prem. So if you need your identity correlation of your on-prem, you know, personas with your cloud personas, you either have to have, you know, you either have to have a solution does both or one solution that does them. And that's really where I see Ping's strength from a confidence standpoint is we were built in the days of on-prem, you know, and we focused on that build and we built it for enterprise clients. I used to be a customer years ago, you know, when I was at JP Morgan Chase. And because that foundation was established, what I find really fascinating, this is another point to the confidence issue. What I find really fascinating is I think we may have passed a point in time where you could actually try and go build a brand new on-prem solution. Because the architecture is no longer singularly on-prem. And so, you'd have to build in a set of capabilities that would be so much broader than back in the days of AD, LDAP and you know how we got started, right?
Let me blow your mind. I had a conversation with a senior director last week who said who this company in financial services has done that and continues to do that because they resist the cloud. Can you believe that? But I think this key of hybrid is mm-hmm. really important mm-hmm. In terms of you know, having this broad view of identity in terms of visibility and policy enforcement and, as you mentioned, proofing, because it's, you know, growing importance in the onboarding and continuous sort of adaptive authentication, if you will. But yet there are some vendors out there that think that just destroying and killing the passwords is going to make a difference, you know. Passwordless authentication is definitely getting a lot of press lately. But that seems so 2004. You know, Bill Gates himself predicted the demise of passwords, and some view killing passwords as an existential threat to the volition of their Fifth Amendment rights. You know, so while others like Microsoft view it as a state of nirvana, you know, further, you know, in research conducted by the popular password manager Dashlane, it was found that the number of passwords we use in the U.S. Is doubling every 5 years. So while we would all love to eliminate the risk of compromised and weak passwords, can you really expect to kill them? And how will this passwordless future unfold? You know, and how are you and Ping Identity Collective thinking and anticipating that?
Well, it's... So there's two parts for me on this passwordless equation. There's the first, which is the stuff that you see in the marketing pitches, which I find valueless, right? And the reason is because passwordless is not about security in that pitch. Passwordless is about a better user experience. And one of the big failings that we've had in propagating bad cybersecurity behaviors is businesses or business partners love to say, hey, put that security solution in. But what I want you to do is I want you to do all the custom configuration necessary in order for my people that have to interface with it to have the same exact experience they had with the old solution. Right. We don't enforce the demands for process change. Same with customers. We want to do passwordless in this marketing tranche about how sexy it's going to be because we want it to be easier for that person. The truth is that easy and security mm-hmm. don't go in the same mm-hmm. sentence together. Never have. And I got some pushback on this the other day. We're like, well, we should make it easy. I'm like, no, not really. No, what we should do is make it frictionless. And I've just seen some, you know, some friction, type of, presentations popping up recently, but I've been saying this for a long time. You know, this comes back to the intelligence piece. We can get to a passwordless world when we're able to answer the magic question. Are you who you say you are? Which is an authentication function. And if we're able to do that with a high degree of confidence, you know, a password becomes irrelevant. right? We're able to identify you based upon a number of different attributes that we're able to apply, risk scoring your profile. Yep, 99.99% sure that's you, which is, you know, that would be a huge, like, light year leap over where we are with most realities today in terms of whether or not we know if that person is who they say they are. So passwordless to me is almost a secondary function of creating frictionless authentication, and not just authenticating once on entry and maybe one more time on elevation, but being authenticated multiple times in session while it's happening, as long as you're inside the digital front door, right? And then when you exit, that relationship stops. That's going to be the real advent of passwordless, not just just saying that we're going to get rid of passwords.
This whole idea of frictionless is a good one. I would add there's this other dimension which doesn't get a lot of airtime, which is volition. You know, you've already heard, like with Touch ID and biometric authentication, that it can be abused by, let's say, law enforcement, forcing a, you know, someone who has his Miranda rights, who has rights of innocent before being proven guilty, that, you know, law enforcement might take the device, his phone, and, you know, force him to authenticate and access his device before having a subpoena. And so I think one, you know, I'm curious to hear your thoughts about this. You know, one dimension of this passwordless future is, are we also giving up our own volition to have this frictionless experience, and how do we compensate for that?
Yeah, the thing that I find the most fascinating about the freedom that I've been given in this position with Ping Identity is the opportunity to do nothing but think about these subjects all the time. And I just had a series of conversations just when I started. And those conversations were about, hey, I'm doing some work, a friend of mine doing some work in Canada. And, you know, we're trying to figure out how to, you know, serve the underserved population when it comes to digital identities. They are disabled. They're illiterate. They have, you know, they got they're in a difficult socioeconomic status. Everything in Canada is now digitized. How do you introduce somebody into a digital economy when they don't have a digital persona? That really got me to thinking. My entire career in identity, all I've ever thought about is identity in the corporate setting. And I never really thought about digital identity for the people. I never really thought about this notion that if we decide that MFA is only through a handset, even though there's supposedly 4 or 5 handsets per, you know, every human being on the earth, there's still 1 billion people with no handset and no cell service. So have we actively disenfranchised those people? I say all that to kind of come back to the specific response to your point, which is, I believe that we're embarking on a frontier where we're going to need to sort out everything that we sorted out in the analog relative to rights and privileges and citizenship in the digital space. Now that identity is becoming a real securitized thing, we're going to have to figure out what it looks like in the digital from all of those aspects, right? What is it? The Miranda reference is a great one, because the Miranda reference is related to the analog world. It's related to the real world, right? Yeah. What is the Good Miranda question. Equivalent? Yeah.
So
in the digital world?
Do you
undefined, right?
Do you like podcasting, yeah, Richard? I'd love to trade jobs with you for a little bit. And you've obviously put some thought into this, and as we're kind of just kind of, you know, wrapping up here, your answer leads into my next real serious question, which I'm going to leave it open ended for you, because, you know, I'm definitely curious. I don't work for Ping. I don't, you know, I'm not a Ping customer. I don't watch the Ping news every single day. You know, but what I can tell from attending Identityverse and, you know, reading the news, Ping Identity has definitely grown up a bit. No longer a startup. I don't think the killer app is single sign-on anymore, right? It's ubiquitous. And in some cases, like open source, it's free. GDPR, PSD2, as you mentioned, and recently the California Consumer Privacy Act of 2018, it seems like, and I'm guessing here, because I'm not that close to the Ping solution set, that your focus on access and API security and data governance and directory services through your acquisition of Unbound ID, which I also thought was brilliant, and adaptive authentication, that Ping is positioned very well for this, analog to digital future, if you will, or you know, the demands on customer identity, European and state of California regulations. So am I imagining things, or is Ping really doing some pretty awesome things and strategic moves and setting itself up for this next wave of success the next few years? Please do.
Well, I'm going to personalize the response to that, because I think it'll tie really well to the questions at the very beginning of the discussion. And I say this with humility. Every time I get up and speak, whether it's in front of 10 people or 3,000, I always remind people. I tell them I'm not an expert, right? I am somebody that was in the trenches, took the beatings, accumulated the scars. You know, my hope in all of this is that as I share these stories and these experiences and these pointers and these guides on how to navigate all this stuff, that I'm able to be a help to people based on that experience, so that you don't duplicate the same mistakes that I did. But that being said, I've obviously been able to build up a pretty successful career, and I have I have a certain degree of visibility. Like I like to tell my father, I'm famous with 12 people around the world. So I've worked hard to get there, and I'd leave off with this relative to Ping's future. A person like me with the corporate background, with the, any number of options to have gone back to the Big Four, to have gone to another solutions provider, or gone back into another CISO role or CSO role, I chose to be at Ping. I chose to be here based upon what I see, the potential, the opportunity, not just for the solution itself, but for the entire industry. There's room for all of us that have been, in the fight now for several years. I think that's what's so important about IDSA. We're all in the fight, right? We may be pushing each other for market share, but at the end of the day, their weakness is my weakness and my weakness is theirs. And I've chosen to be a Ping identity because everything that you just described, all of those pieces, parts, and components aligning is exactly the type of approach that I think is going to be extremely successful in the
well,
marketplace.
I think that Andre couldn't have chosen a better person for the role of customer advocate, with the breadth of your background and to help Ping identity customers think through this future and, to not have to, drink the Kool-Aid, but go into it eyes wide open with some real practical experience with, support from someone like you. So. I guess in wrapping up, Richard, I might not have given you a proper introduction or do your background justice, but probably a lot of folks listening to this might already know you. So let's just, have a little bit of, in the spirit of having fun and getting to know you better, amuse me and the listeners, and let me ask a few personal questions. Is that okay? So what color of bow tie are you wearing today?
Yes. I have a favorite that is blue with a actual old school tattoo pattern on it.
Nice, Matt. And I know
that's one of my favorites.
You have a few tattoos, and I don't want that I need to go into those. That might be a little too personal. But how about your favorite food?
Oh man, charcuterie. I know it's more than one food. But that's what makes it special. So give me some cheese and some, some
what
cured
CD
meats
or MP3
and
was
and
last
jam,
played in
I'm
your
good
car.
To go. I really don't listen too much in the car, but I'm a huge music fan. I do music festivals. And at Bonnaroo this year, which I'm going to for the fourth time, the Lonely Island, which is a Andy Samberg in-joke type of band from Saturday Night Live, I've been listening to him quite a bit, and it's
good
really
one.
Inappropriate.
Favorite vacation destination.
But very funny. So, really good. Anything along the seacoast in
Perfect.
Ireland. I worked there for
Colorado.
A little bit. Yeah, I love it there.
But speaking of Denver and of Ping Identity, who's your favorite Ping Identity thought leader that you love to follow?
Oh, that's a toss up any given time. Rob Reck, I think I have a tremendous amount of respect for
residency. So
you know the person that sits in the seat, and Rob sits in that CISO seat.
Oh, good choice.
Yeah, and Bernard Hodnegay. I could listen to him speak a lot, or almost endlessly. And the only problem is, most of the times I only understand about 20% of it.
Performance review,
because he's and that smart. So
tracked by how much you understand of Bernard's conversation. Okay.
What technology
or opportunity are you most excited about in 2019?
I'd blockchain, say federated blockchain. I'm a real, it's funny. I'm not, right. This is my problem. I'm a skeptic by design, and the notion of I'll just give a brief example, but the notion of an immutable ledger immediately kind of falls flat for me, because if I think about identity, if one of your defining characteristics is marital status, but you've been separated for 2 years because you can't stand each other, and you definitely don't want Bob to have access to your checking account, and Sally doesn't want him to have access to a retirement account, what exactly is your status on the blockchain? You're married, right? I think that the nuances of real life don't manifest themselves well in blockchain, but federated blockchain, where there are more opportunities relative to who has and controls the ledger,
I think it's only getting interesting.
It's fascinating to me.
Pure play identity management companies like Ping and others are going to have to grapple with this at some point. You know, headline from today: Sovereign Network now ready for digital credential issuers. So we might have to save that for another podcast, but I think there's definitely, something new and noteworthy happening in this space. And this year, it's coming at us pretty fast. Well, Richard, it's been a lot of fun. I'm glad we finally found the time on our calendars to get this done. We should do this more often. Sounds good.
Agreed. Cheers, I look forward to trying it again. All right. Thanks so much. Bye.